Hello, Kate Lamb here, and you're listening to Asia Calling. Coming up on the show this week, we'll be hearing from women writers in conflict, from Bangladesh to Kashmir to Kosovo, on seeking refuge in Sri Lanka and in Indonesia, art as salve for schizophrenia. Welcome to Asia Calling, and thanks for tuning into the show. Conflict and war impact on women and girls in specific ways, experiences of trauma, of abuse and bravery that often go unheard and untold. Well, this week from the Jaipur Literature Festival in India, Jasvinder Sehgal hears from women writers in Bangladesh, India and Kosovo on just what it's like to be a woman in a conflict zone.
And in the second part of my book, Tal Hawa, I described how I was oppressed and tortured by my husband and how I was forced to divorce him.
Facing the fury of Islamic fundamentalists, Bangladeshi author Taslima Nasreen has been living in exile since 1994. Today she's here at the Jaipur Literature Festival, where hundreds have gathered to hear her read from her memoir, Exile.
You know, because I don't feel safe, so that I have to leave the country, I never think of that. I have seen how many writers and secular writers are hacked to death in Bangladesh. So I think that this should be stopped.
Taslima is known for her powerful feminist writing and unflinching criticism of religion. She first started writing at age 13 and today has published more than 40 books. But at home, her work has been blacklisted and banned, forcing her into exile as she fled multiple fatwas calling for her death. But that hasn't stopped Taslima from voicing her views.
I believe in one world because I don't believe in nationalism. I believe in humanism. I believe in rationalism, rather. I believe in rights and freedom.
Shazia Umar is another writer from Bangladesh who is also keenly aware of the limitations at home. Over recent years, several writers, bloggers, and publishers in Bangladesh have been killed in attacks by Islamic extremists.
And it's in fact become a really difficult country to write in. In the last 2 years, 30 writers have been hacked to death by machetes. Luckily, so far, all of the 30 that have been killed have been men. I think there aren't so many female writers to begin with. This movement of Islamicization, a radical version of it, I believe we have to stop it by creating dialogue about plurality of faith, about different ways of expressing Islam.
Shazia, one of the very few Bangladeshi English fiction writers, has written on drug abuse, intentional happiness, and Islam. But writing from Bangladesh is becoming increasingly difficult, she says.
I faced fear. I had to question myself many times that should I write a book that explores different dimensions of Islam when it's such a risky topic in the country? And sometimes I thought maybe I shouldn't. Why am I putting my neck out? But at the end of the day, as a writer, I felt I couldn't write a book that didn't address the topics that I wanted to.
Women that were coming on the train from the north of Israel to the south, in all stations coming on the trains, doing a march to inaugurate the movement. And since then, when I'm saying 10,000 women, it's really women. And you know, I know it sounds in India, 10,000 sounds such a small scale thing.
For the first time this year, the Jaipur Literature Festival is hearing from women in conflict zones about the unique challenges and perspectives women face in times of conflict and war, like those of activist Ruchira Gupta, who shared her experience of working in Kosovo for the United Nations.
The violence at that time that I saw, which was related to conflict, was heart-wrenching. You know, there was the trafficking of women. There was also the use of local women by soldiers who were posted there and supposed to guard them, and taking sex against favors that they would do in a time of shortages during war, where brothels opened up in absolutely normal residential neighborhoods. to feed this growing army of soldiers from different countries.
Ruchira was instrumental in the passing of Resolution 1325 at the UN Security Council, which addresses the impact of war and conflict on women and girls.
Because we are talking about conflict areas. One may or may not agree with the conflict at all, but these are the things which women in conflict areas go through.
Kashmiri poetess Naseem Shafai, the first women poet from Kashmir to win the prestigious Sahitya Akademi Literary Award, also joined the discussion. Naseem writes about the turbulent atmosphere of Kashmir, one of the most militarized zones in the world, from a woman's perspective, especially the impact on her family life.
It was difficult because my family went through very difficult times. My husband was abducted. He was shot at 5 times, shot at an abdomen and shoulder. Then it took me so many years, and then I had to move from Srinagar to Delhi for his treatment. We came out of that period, that trauma. God has been very kind to me.
From the safety of Jaipur, Rajasthan, this is Jaswinder Sehgal speaking to Brave Women Writers for Isha Calling.
Mental illness in Indonesia is grossly misunderstood. In some cases, people with mental illness are even shackled in chains. But with proper support and medication, people suffering from mental illness can live productive, happy, and independent lives. For Dunanda Agun Cristianto, something else has given him relief too: painting. Reporter Eli Camila hears his story of using art as a way to cope with schizophrenia.
Mas tu ya?
Iya.
Oh, yeah. Eli.
Dwinanda Agung Cristiano welcomes me into his home in East Jakarta. He lives in a two-story house, and his artworks, mostly abstract paintings, are hung in every room. One painting, titled Window, is on display in the living room. Rather than canvas, the base of the painting is an old blackboard. In the middle, there's a scratch of chalk, fashioned in the shape of a window, while on the right side there's a staircase that leads to a door.
That door and stairs describe my experience, that it is not easy to recover, that I should reach for every stair. When I arrive at the front of the door, I know I'm a schizophrenic, and there's a glass bottle. It's my memory about the psychiatrist who said that to eliminate the effect of drugs, I have to drink a lot of water.
Dwinanda has been diagnosed with schizophrenia, a chronic mental disorder where the patient experiences delusions, hallucinations, anxiety, and behavioral changes. Now 33, Dwinanda has lived with schizophrenia for more than 10 years. He explains what it was like at first.
2005 mulai orang keluarga terdekat tuh merasa ada sesuatu yang.
In 2005, my close family felt that something was wrong with me. I talk a lot, but my family couldn't understand me, what I was saying. I was taken to a counselor and pastor, but they couldn't find anything wrong with me, no witchcraft or anything.
Tapi dari mereka tidak ada ditemukan sesuatu yang serius, apakah saya diguna-guna, kan biasanya itu kan isunya kan.
In Indonesia, mental illness is often explained by way of superstition or black magic. The belief that a person suffering from mental illness has been possessed by an evil or bad spirit. That's why it took Dwinanda's family some time before they took him to a doctor. They didn't believe it was a medical problem, even though he was clearly suffering.
Sampai akhirnya saya dalam kondisi tidak berfungsi.
Eventually, I came to a point where all my sense organs did not work anymore. My eyesight was blurry. I couldn't smell. My hearing was diminished. My mouth was stiff and my hands were tingling.
When Dwananda's family did take him to see a psychiatrist, he was diagnosed with schizophrenia. The diagnosis, he says, after the physical symptoms and delusions, was a relief.
Mulai hari ini akan saya share rutin bagaimana rasanya zat bernama skizofrenia beserta segala gejala kondisi.
Dwananda pulls out a diary from those years, explaining that he wrote a lot during that time.
I didn't know if I was delusional or not. I just wrote to lighten the complicated words that appeared in my mind. This writing became material for the psychiatrist to analyze my condition. But at that time, I didn't know what I wrote was delusional. But the people around me knew.
Dwananda also uses art as a form of therapy. His scribbles on paper, he jokes, are his dopamine. And over the years, he's produced hundreds of paintings, which are kept at his gallery in Jakarta, Ruang Seni Ago. Dwananda has returned to a normal life now, with the help of medication, art, and family support. His father, Hadi Darmo, explains.
Ya, ya dibantu dalam arti kita berikan di kita berikan suatu.
We help by supporting him. We help to remind him because he just kept silent. So I talked to him, asked him to walk with me, to go to a movie or a bookstore. I accompanied him, but it was hard at the beginning.
Experts agree that family support is essential to help relatives suffering from mental illness. As for Dwananda, he's proof that those with mental illness can work to overcome them. This year, he's even planning a solo exhibition of his artwork, including some works that have been stored away for years.
I saved some of my paintings for a solo exhibition called Jejak Waktu, or Traces of Time 2017. I have let them get dusty, but I will show them whatever their condition.
From Jakarta, this story was produced by Ellie Kamila for Asia Calling.
You're listening to Asia Calling on KBR. Pakistan is ranked among the most dangerous countries in the world for religious minorities. Marginalised and persecuted on the basis of their faith, members of minority groups such as Christians and Ahmadiyya regularly flee the country. Thousands end up living in despair and in limbo in countries such as Indonesia, Thailand and Sri Lanka. From Negombo, Asia Calling correspondent Naeem Sohutra has this story.
These young choir members are singing hymns in the city of Negombo, in Sri Lanka's south, singing for strength and patience in these difficult times. Unlike this in Hali or Tamil languages spoken in the island nation, they are singing in Urdu, the national language of Pakistan. There is about 100 people here, members of Pakistan's Christian minority, who fled the country to seek asylum in Sri Lanka. This woman tells me of her tragic love story, but asked that I don't use her name. It's a story of being united in love, but divided in faith. As a Muslim woman, she broke taboo and married a Christian man, a move that outraged her family, even sparking calls to have her husband killed. In Pakistan, interfaith marriages are rare, and even rarer these days, with growing religious intolerance. Fearing for their safety, the interfaith couple fled to Sri Lanka 3 years ago. Thousands of people from religious minority groups in Pakistan, such as Christians, Shia and Ahmadiyya, flee persecution and discrimination by the Sunni Muslim majority. Militant groups linked to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda have openly attacked their houses of worship, killing hundreds and injuring many more. It's why many people leave, seeking a better life elsewhere. They come to places like Negombo, which today looks like a mini Pakistan, with hundreds of Pakistanis living here quietly, almost unnoticed. Most of them don't want to be identified. 50-year-old Jessica William arrived here with her four children and two grandchildren in 2012.
वजह बस यही थी कि वो patient care करता था.
My son worked as a male nurse, and he used to visit some Muslim patients in their homes. One day, he was taking a patient to the doctor when they came under armed attack. My son was shot. Later, he found out that those people had links with terrorists. He was so scared that he left the job and left the country. Those people started searching for my son and harassed the family, so we also left our home.
Colombo has enjoyed good diplomatic relations with Islamabad, which helped it end militancy by the Tamils, who were allegedly supported by India. But things dramatically changed 2 years ago when the Sri Lankan authorities stopped issuing visas on arrival to Pakistanis, in fear of an influx of terrorists. Some 100 migrants, mostly men, were forcibly sent back. Political observers say New Delhi was putting pressure on Colombo to counter the growing influence of Islamabad in the island nation. That has left hundreds of asylum seekers stranded and scared. During my visit to the city, four Pakistani bishops who are attending the International Bishops Conference in Colombo also arrived to meet the frustrated families. The migrants pleaded with the bishops to press America or European countries to take them in. People like Jessica here in this hall are angry and fed up.
We cannot work. Whatever we can, we do it secretly because we have to pay thousands for rent, let alone food and other things. We spend life in a constant fear. I work as a head of a charity organization that help and shelter children with special needs. I used to clean and care for the children of others. But today, there is no one to protect my children.
Sri Lanka might be an attractive place to tourists, known for its lush green mountains and beautiful temples. But the life of migrants tells otherwise, says Jessica.
We fight with snakes and other animals every day. We have no access to the hospitals, schools or jobs. We are forced to secretly work to buy food and pay rent. I've one piece of advice for you, son. Think of yourself before thinking of anyone else.
Following criticism from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, or UNHCR, the Sri Lankan government has stopped the deportations. But the lengthy asylum processes is still testing the patience of migrants from Pakistan. Some have even been here for 10 years, their asylum requests denied, they now live in hiding. For Asia Calling, this is Naim Sohotra in Negombo, Sri Lanka.
Finally, on Asia Calling. What's the point of going to the supermarket or the market if you can just click a button on your phone? China's embrace of e-commerce now extends to food shopping. The value of China's online sales and goods is already larger than the EU and the US combined. And the country's early embrace of smartphones has made it even more convenient to click and buy. In the lead up to Chinese New Year, Mark Godfrey has this story from Beijing.
My name is Eric Lee. I'm from Yiguo, e-commerce company. We are the biggest online.
Eric Lee is vice president of Yiguo. He spends a lot of time on the road convincing suppliers of fresh food to sell their goods on his website. He talked to me on his way to meet a delegation of foreign meat exporters visiting China.
We found out the consumer is demand for fresh food is very resilient with the current financial correction. So also the slowdown for the economy. We provide different additional value compared with the traditional retail channel in terms of freshness, safety, and also price is also very competitive.
International food exporters are seeing competition for their products among Chinese online retailers like Tmall.com and Yihaodian.com. Sigmund Bjørgo is the China representative of the Norwegian Seafood Council and is known as an expert on marketing fresh food in China.
It's a seller's market because all the platforms need the international products. So they are kind of pushing more. The buyers are pushing more than the sellers are pushing. They need it because their customers are requesting more imported international seafood, and it's a part of them to build a brand. Like Jingdong, Yihaodian, Tmall, all of this want to appear to be the most professional, most successful, and also most international company. This is part of them to attract loyalty to their own customers. So, but it's the same as traditional retail. It's always about being the first one to introduce a new product.
So why is e-commerce so big in China? I asked Robin Wang, who set up a marketing consultancy in Shanghai called SMH International to handle online sales and marketing in China for Western food companies. Wang is busy overseeing promotions for Chinese New Year, which falls in late January.
Yeah, because this is a trend for Chinese consumer and also getting very popular among all the white collar and also the all the consumers in China. And also China right now is ranking the number one for the e-commerce country, so surpass the U.S. And also the lifestyles change. The people with the very, very fast work pace, you know, they don't have the time to go to the actually supermarket to do the purchasing. Everyone use the smartphone and just go to download the app. You know, you can do everything, just click. The products can just right in front of your home.
But Sigmund Bjørgo thinks e-commerce isn't always ideal for perishable food products in China.
And the biggest challenge is from the last warehouse, the hub, and on the scooters, the last mile home to consumers. And the problem is both from packaging. It's on the time it takes, it's a temperature, and then what happens if the consumer is not at home. This is the weakest link. You can control everything until it reaches the last hub, but you cannot today control, as a brand owner, the last mile.
While there are some concerns, such as counterfeiting of foreign goods, many are optimistic. Robin Wang predicts a big future for e-commerce in China.
And for the Chinese consumer, their receiving new things is very fast. You know, and also the Chinese people are very smart, you know. So, you know, and also for the consumer wise, they really find the beneficial because it's cheaper and also fast and also reduce hassle to go into the actually supermarket.
As Chinese New Year approaches, the shopping rush is picking up pace. But this year, a lot of the sales will be happening online. Beijing native Shan Shan is typical of the new breed of Chinese shopper.
There's a good choice. It's convenient and the quality is better. And you can get special products, speciality foodstuffs.
Rather than go to the market, she's buying all her food online for the upcoming New Year celebrations. The 25-year-old accountant likes trying imported foods. For Asia Calling, this is Mark Godfrey in Beijing.
That's all for this edition of Asia Calling. Our program today was produced in the studios of Radio KBR in Jakarta, Indonesia. To find out more about our show, send us a message on our Asia Calling Facebook page and follow us on Twitter @AsiaCalling. I'm Kate Lamb, back next week with more stories from Asia.
ใครทำให้ฉัน